I'm Eric Davis, and I want to invite you to join me for
Hey, 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 it's Mark Farrell. The show is Insights on the Progressive Radio Network. Brr, it's cold in New York City. A week ago today, it was in the high 80s, and the humidity was so thick that the windshield wipers slash con artists slash people who threaten to take all your money if you don't have them clean your windshield washers couldn't even get the muck off your windshield because the humidity was so thick. That's how hot it was. And today it's like 38 degrees. But I love it. We got to get rid of all these bugs. And New York always smells a little bit better when it's colder. We got a great show for you today. Of course, I'm biased. You're going to meet an incredible artist, a supremely talented artist, Laura Meddens. She has taken a non-traditional path. But then again, what artist has taken a traditional path in life? She's visually impaired. She has a really, really attractive guide dog that we're going to hear from as well. No, Nugget. Nugget, you can't speak right now. Okay, easy, Nugget. Down, boy. And so she has come all the way from Holland to be on the Progressive Radio Network. Well, I guess she's here to do some other things as well, but I'd like to think that she came all this way to be on our show. Of course, we'd love to hear from you, 888-874-4888. Actually, my phone is lighting up. My doctor is calling me with my blood results. I kid you not. So I wonder if I should run a commercial right now or a promo and find out my fate. Is my blood sugar high? Is my glucose, good glucose? Or I forget that. I got to review that document. But I check that form, you know, where they're not allowed to leave you a message. Because, you know, you don't want to be left bad news. I mean, I'm sure it's going to be good news because it's not like I'm overweight or lethargic. I'm always on the move, always exercising. Anyway, I was just on the bus as well, and they were trying to call me, and I couldn't talk about my personal health on the New Jersey Transit bus. Anyway, 2 minutes after the hour of 11 o'clock in New York City, how the hell are you feeling today? Great, great. You look damn good. So I want to talk about what's really, really irking me, and hopefully irking you. The tragic death, of course it's not confirmed that he's dead, of the Washington Post reporter in Saudi Arabia. Actually, it happened in Turkey at the consulate, in the Saudi Arabian consulate, which is just mind-boggling that, I mean, the complete buffoons Trump and Pompeo, Secretary of State, are acting like they are being told the absolute truth. And it's just like when Trump went over to Russia and was told by Putin, yes, we did not interfere at all in the election. So he takes it, excuse me, for face value. And this is incredible because, first of all, it just came out in the last few hours that $100 million payment was made to the U.S. last week. Hello? Is that hush money? Is that payoff money? And you know what's the clearest thing about this whole debacle is that the Saudis can't obviously expedite a covert operation or a cover-up. I mean, that's the clearest thing because, first of all, on video, you have the Washington reporter walking into the consulate, not leaving. You have a doctor arriving with a saw. I mean, why does a doctor, a top-ranked Saudi Arabian doctor, arrive and get summoned to the consulate with a saw that's usually used for a dismemberment? I mean, what? You can't make this stuff up. This sounds like a Ocean's like 20. What movie are they on now? Ocean's 19, 16? I don't know. But it's just kind of crazy. And then you get a cleaning crew and then a painting crew. So what is going on here? Obviously, there was a major I can't say, well, okay, we can speculate. Obviously, he was taken out. Taken out in probably a very grotesque and violent way, because if you need a painting crew, that's not like we got a little stain on a carpet, let's get some new carpet. No, that means there was splatter. It sounds like an organized crime, you know, mob takeout, where he was tortured, threatened, obviously because he's in the media. And he published last a week ago Wednesday a piece in the op-ed. Poof. Into thin air. Actually, he submitted it. I don't think it aired until... I'm not sure of the air date, so I don't want to misspeak. But it's obviously he's very candid about the Middle East, about politics, and this is the fallout. And I feel horrible for his family. I'm embarrassed for our country, our nation, that this is how we handle a potential international crisis. This has been going on for a week and a half, 2 weeks, where we're finally finding out more and more. And the thing that really gets me, I mean, there's so many different aspects of this, is that Pompeo went there yesterday and spoke to the crown prince or prince? I forget. It's ridiculous. About what was going to happen. But he was told the prince would not talk about this. Well, why? Why would you go there? You have to threaten trade embargo. I mean, tariffs. I mean, obviously, Trump is very tariff heavy. So tax him. Do what you need to do. Hit him in a pocketbook. Don't make us look like a bunch of wimps. I mean, our country looks pitiful, ridiculous. I mean, if any other president was in power, regardless of power, they would take care of this in a very dignified way, certainly to the face of the American people. But the fact that you're just saying to the American people, well, we trust what they say is true. Come on. That is far from accurate. Are you 5 years old? This is absurd. And the tapes. Why have we not got the tapes? Because Turkey apparently says tapes exist. Well, why don't we have possession of them? What is on the tape? So more and more stuff is coming out, I'm sure by the hour, by the day, and we'll report back to you. But this is something that's just very, very absurd. And what really is interesting is this $100 million payment that doesn't really have a defined trajectory in terms of use. Why is this and where is this going to be allocated? Is this money earmarked for a certain purpose? And how did we find out about this? Who found out about this? I'm not sure if the Washington Post did. Interesting, actually, late breaking news yesterday, someone from the Federal Treasury got fired, a high ranking. I'm kind of going off on a tangent here, a splinter off point. But it's interesting because they may have been or trying to become a whistleblower for the Russian investigation because documents were leaked about financial statements of people that are being investigated. So it's going to be interesting to see the timing of that coinciding with this, because I don't think things of this matter are accidental. They happen for a reason, and the timing is far from accidental or coincidental. So it's just crazy when you think about like a modern day rub out. The Saudis obviously have not done this well, and they didn't prepare for the Americans. I mean, are they that confident that Trump was not going to be bold and thorough and demanding and say, listen, this is what I want. This is what I demand. At least put on a face for the American people, Trump, and act like a serious statesman, a person of the Oval Office that won't take any crap from another country, especially when it's someone's life was taken. Oh, very, 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 very frustrating. So from a very, very serious topic, we're going to bring it down several notches to Canada blazing up. Canada is now the second nation to legalize pot. I think Uruguay was the first one a couple years ago, maybe in 2013. And, you know, it's interesting because they say that this is going to benefit kids because kids get pot too easily nowadays in Canada. I don't know if that's true, but I imagine it is. So the legalization and regulation will make it a little bit more stringent and less money for criminals and organized crime. Well, I'm sure that's the case. I can just see the first thing I think of when I hear about Canada legalizing pot is like their flag. You know, that isn't the oak leaf, but it's going to be like the cannabis flag. Because if you've ever traveled, you always see, especially when I've traveled after college over Europe, I spent 2 months in Europe backpacking, And everyone from Canada always had their sticker or emblem emblazed, stitched on their backpack. And I can always see that flag. So when I think of Canada, the first thing I think of is that they're going to have to switch their national flag. The moniker is going to have to be a plant leaf. But the thing that gets me is, one more thing is that they're introducing salivation saliva tests. Not you, Nugget. No, the dog started getting into this story here, where if someone's caught impaired driving due to marijuana use, they'll have a saliva test, which apparently is fairly accurate. So that brings me to my point where I am on the fence in terms of our country legalizing marijuana. Now, I don't want to be a hypocrite. Have I smoked my fair share of pot? Way more than my fair share of pot in my day. But the reality is, let's keep it in check. I think we need to deal with the current two epidemics that we have. Number one, the digital epidemic. How people are far from focused on what they need to be doing when they're driving or operating machinery or even computers and posting stuff on Facebook or any social media that I feel like they're under a spell as it is. So if they're actually inebriated or stoned out of their minds, I think number one, driving. Is a saliva test going to, would it take place in the States? Of course it'd have to be to hold people accountable. But I just don't think in this day and age, we need to legalize pot on a national level unless there's real credible, like if we have Canada as our test country for 5 years and we can see the results. As a socialized nation, things are a little bit different. And we're actually going to be touching on a socialized medicine in Laura Medden's interview as well. But the reality is, I just don't think that it's appropriate. I think we'll be too cavalier. As a nation and as a use for kids, I think they're saying that the availability won't be as easily or readily available as it is now, but I disagree. I just think with the opioid crisis, point number two, that is something we need to get into check. So if you couple the opioid use with pot use, you have a serious issue. But I think it is, people say sometimes it's not a gateway drug, pot. I think it is a gateway drug. I started smoking pot as young as fifth grade. I did for many different reasons, for peer acceptance, self-confidence, none of that worked. But that was my rationale back then. So I just think it's something that the nation does not need. I don't think individuals need it. I think it's just bad for schools, bad for education. Kids will be getting stoned going to school as they do already. So I just don't think it needs to be more ubiquitous and easier to obtain. I disagree with the fact that it's going to be harder to get because it's going to be regulated. There's always going to be a black market. I think the weed will be better. I think it'll be more potent. Therefore, another reason why that it should not be legalized because of the effects. And again, the reality is, I just want our nation to not be the dumbest nation in the world and a safe nation, because it goes back to even just texting and driving. Drive anywhere in this country and watch the car in front of you. Chances are between point A and point B, wherever your destination is, whether it's 5 minutes away or 50 minutes away, you're going to see somebody swerving in broad daylight, not most likely because they're drinking and driving, most likely because they're not paying attention because they're using their digital device, their phone, iPad, laptop, who knows, or all the above. So that's one more reason why we need to keep pot from being legal. Again, I don't want to sound like a hypocrite. Yes, I publicly speak about getting stoned and using many, many other drugs openly and far from recreationally for years. And that's why I speak from experience, because I do have this vast experience of using too many drugs, and that was the door that opened it up for me, thinking, well, I did this, that was okay, pot was okay, well, I can drink, drinking was okay. I mean, alcohol use is legal, and I think we should keep it at that. Alcohol is dangerous as it is. I have many, many episodes, periods of my life, if you put them all together, years of out-of-control reckless drinking and legal legalization of alcohol, I think, is fine. We'll keep it at that. I don't think pot needs to. So you understand my position on that. Yes, good. Glad you do. There's one thing I want to mention. I'm not going to get into it because I want to do a full story on this in the near future. But I started doing yoga recently because, number one, I needed a mental change because I was teaching spin 3 days a week. And being an outdoor rider, a runner, weightlifter, et cetera, I've just been doing that for years and years and years, getting very, very bored. And also your body begins to change and break down, but mostly for the mental change. And I started doing it about, 3-4 weeks ago. I could not be happier. I am such a cliche of everything that I've read about how yoga's changed my life. It's this, that, and the other thing. And so far, it's absolutely spot on. It's hysterical. I just feel better. I have more energy, which my wife hates because I have enough energy as it is. But she's the one who actually started me on it. I did it years ago, but not to this extent. And I haven't done yoga for about 13 years. But I just want to convey to you that if you're on the fence, whether it's for just easing the mind, quieting those voices, relaxing, toning your body, getting a great workout. I'm telling you, I've done most workouts available out there, and this is an incredible workout. Yes, of course, it depends on your instructor and the facility, but already I've narrowed down every instructor that I've liked at this facility that I go to, and I feel it big time the next day because I push myself and I find myself on off days doing it on my own, just a few minutes, maybe 5-10 minutes. So we're going to do a segment on this. I'm going to bring a specialist in here, a yogi, or someone who knows a great deal about this. This is not a sport, a lifestyle. It's been around for thousands and thousands of years. So do your homework. Try yoga if you like. If you don't, leave me to do my homework, and I'll get back to you, and we'll do some convincing. So I want to introduce you to someone who's a friend of the show. Laura Meddins was first on the show about over a year ago. And I was quite taken with her story. Number one, she's just a marvelous person, very affable. And she is a survivor on many levels. Number one, she's been visually impaired for many, many years, and then her vision declined. And we're going to hear all these different stories and how they one affected and impacted the other. But more importantly, how she has become so resilient. One of the things I talk about when I speak at schools, colleges, and corporations is about overcoming adversity. And everyone's story is different. And yes, some stories are just, you know, make you just stop in your tracks and just go like, how can somebody survive and go on? And this is one of the stories where someone just says, you know what? Yes, I've experienced adversity. And this is what I like to do. And this is a passion of mine, and I'm going to continue to do it. And so her artistry has not been lessened. It's blossomed. It's become something that's larger than life. It's more of an expression than she can probably even articulate. So with that in mind, I should introduce you to the incredibly talented Laura Meddins. Hello, Laura.
Hi, Mark.
Come on a little bit closer to that microphone.
I will. Yeah. Yes.
Don't be afraid to grab that microphone.
Okay.
We're at a candlelit dinner.
Yes.
Right? Okay. Table for two in New York City. By the way, welcome to New York City.
Thank you.
How many times have you been here?
I've been here 3 times, I think, right, Jen? Yeah.
But 2 times have been without me.
Yes.
So this is by far going to be your best experience.
This is the first time, yes.
But you have a great date tonight with Sir Elton John, I believe.
Yes, I'm going there.
Yeah, I'm still waiting for an invite. And Jan is here from the Seeing Eye Dog in Morristown, New Jersey. Well, Hi, Jan. Hello.
I
got an invite from Rick and Jan.
Oh, Rick and Jen. Okay.
Yes.
Well, yet to be decided. Anyway, welcome to New York City with your guide dog, Nugget, who we kind of referred to earlier in the interview. Now, there are many, many chapters to all of our lives, but you certainly have are no different. And one of your chapters includes an examination that kind of went awry, something that was discovered but not communicated to you during that actual visit. Please tell me about that.
The paintings.
No, the doctor's visit when you had the initial onset of microaneurysms. Ring a bell?
Well, actually, no, because I never talk about those things.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, we don't have to talk about them today. But it was a doctor's visit that apparently went awry.
Yes.
Your vision was impaired.
Yes.
From early on, right?
And I saw, no, it was, my vision got impaired when I was 27.
Well, for some people, that's early on.
Yeah, it is early on. And then, I don't know what it's about. I really don't know. I think it's probably the blue light.
Well, from my information that, well, we don't have to belabor the point, but the reality is it got worse.
Yes.
In about 2007.
Seven.
It's been about 11 years.
Yes, that I'm blind.
Yes. Blind. Yes. One eye during a procedure that they were trying to correct, actually, and you're a type 1 diabetic.
I'll tell you the whole story. If I can do it in my way, then I know exactly what you're talking about.
Well, you know your way better than me.
I'm not a native English speaker, so I'm trying to do that correctly and understand what you're saying, okay? The thing is that I went diving in Curacao, and I'm a diabetic type 1.
What year was this, Laura?
Yes, and this was in 1993. Yes. And I wasn't allowed to dive as a diabetic, but I did. So I had little veins that occurred. And the moment I said I was a diabetic, the eye specialist, who wasn't finished with his study yet, started to laser. And that moment, my eyes started to get blood inside, and they wanted to stop that. And the eye started bleeding, so my retina got scar tissue. And that's one of the reasons I had a sight going from 100% vision to 0.3. So it was all of a sudden, it was a lot less. And then in 2004, they operated me several times to take the blood out. And that made it better in one eye, 30%, my right eye. And they forgot to put insulin in the intravenous, and they added glucose water. So my blood sugar went up very high.
Quite the opposite of their
goal. Quite the opposite, and so that I became blind completely. And right, I could see 30%. They got that back. And it was stable for 14 and a half years. Then in 2007, I don't want to talk about that because that was very personal, but it had to do with a hit. And, a hit, well, I can say, from my ex-husband. And that made it bad, and I couldn't see anymore. So that's the whole story. But I really, and that's really, because I start feeling uncomfortable when I talk about this, because it's not important. Now I'm here, Laura, and I paint, and I can see visualizations that I never could imagine that a blind person could have.
It is kind of important. I don't want to put words in your mouth, because everything kind of formulates who we are and what we become, because a near-death experience allowed you to have visions, correct? And allow the mind's eye to see?
Yes, one of the reasons, but the other reason was the death of my father in 2010. And I could see him then very clearly. And that made me think now, when I look back, it really I realized why I had all those experiences. Yes, it's true what you're saying, but it's more important to realize that what you have now and the mindset you're in now at this moment makes you live.
So artistry has always been something that's drawn and felt important to you?
It has, yes. Yeah.
From what age? Very early on?
Very early on, because my father was an architect, and I used to love him, to see him draw and love him look at old buildings, and I love that. Yeah.
It's peaceful when you watch somebody even just sketching something. Yeah. It's one of those things I could just sit there. Even my daughter, when she draws with her crayons, it's just very relaxing, and you just get lost into their movement.
Yes.
I find that to be beautiful.
Yeah.
So when did you find that painting was such a major release? Was it when your eyes and your vision decreased even more? And tell me about how you realized that a blank canvas, black,
yes,
is your blank canvas, is your beginning.
Yes, my beginning, because I had those visualizations in 2015, my father died in 2010, and they went away, and in 2015, I suddenly got these beautiful visualizations, and it sounds very spiritual, and I do believe, but I don't believe in a religion. I always saw a lit candle in a different color. So it was a white candle, and the black part is, for me, it's eternity. So I saw the black, and I saw the candle lit and burning, and that's the tango painting that I made.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
Is that something that you always still see when you think about that, when you just described it?
I can't get it back. Mm. It's always something that happens, and I have a visualization now as well with different colors. And it can stay there for a half a day, and it can change.
And please go ahead.
And I think it comes from my soul, that it's opened up and that I can see certain images. And I put that onto canvas. But I can only do it when I'm very happy.
Well, I'm sure we always do the best work when we're happiest.
Well, there are artists that painted when they were very,
You're correct. Yeah. You're right. Yes. Jackson Pollock, number one. Yeah. Booze and depression did wonders for him.
Yeah.
Or for us, not for him.
Yeah.
So talk about the actual black canvas.
Yes.
And why that works for you.
Because I think when I look like I'm looking now in my soul, I can see black and a blue candle, which means something for me. It's something that I can see certain things in, and it's a very nice contrast. So that's why I paint it.
So the colors pop much more for you.
They pop much more. And the nice thing is, if you look at my paintings, people always see their own story in my paintings.
And speaking of your paintings, we're going to roll a video right now of your work behind an easel. And here's Laura Meddins.
My name is Laura Meddins, and I love to paint. Just getting the basic thing all black, because it's nicer to have it all black. Now I'm going to start with the red. Usually I put paint on my fingers, and the texture is so nice to feel, and for me it's easier because then I know exactly where to go with the color that I have in my hand. Start with a black background because the visualizations that I have usually got black in the background. In front of those visualizations is, for example, a bright orange or red or green or white, and that makes it very easy for me to see what I'm seeing. I get inspired by a lot of things, especially nature and people. Thank you.
many people that ask me, how can I paint when I'm blind? And my answer to them is that there are many people that can see but don't have a vision. I try to put my vision and my feeling on canvas.
Magnificent work. I love the flow, the energy, and the movement in your work.
Thank you.
And without a paintbrush, your index finger.
Well, all my fingers.
All your fingers.
All my hands and my arms as well sometimes. And the funny thing is when I'm busy and I see the visualization, I sometimes get from inside, like, get this or get that. And I use different things. Yeah. And that's the nice thing that I like when I'm painting, that when I finished, several people look and they say, gosh, I can see a dragon or I can see a sneaky dragon.
Sure, yeah.
And then if 10 people say the same thing, I'm happy because then I know, gosh, it's got something that people see and it's fantastic.
I see that you devised a system. It looks like you count down or you segment your painting when you, so you know where you left off or where you want to conclude or rejoin. Was that a strategy that was hard to come up with or devise?
No, it's something that happens when I'm busy, and I've always known that windows, when I could see, are divided into, they're square
quadrants.
Exactly. So you can just imagine that too, and place your hands to feel, because I see with my hands now. And
discuss the colors and how you developed a pattern and or scheme to discern colors and what color you were obviously looking for, seeking, and actually from the palette to the canvas.
I have a special wood container where 7 bottles fit. And so I have 21 bottles next to each other. And I learn that off by heart, and I know exactly what to get. But the visualizations give me the color. So if I see, for example, a yellow, it can be a gold yellow, but it can be a bright yellow. And I've placed my paintings in such a way that I know where the gold is and where the bright yellow is. So then I grab them while I'm busy, because I'm very into a certain state, maybe the state that you're in when you're into yoga. I'm in a kind of trance, and I don't take any drugs or anything. I don't drink any alcohol, but it's just a state that you're in, that you're connected to the, it's very special. And then I start to paint, and I see the colors. So that's what I grab.
Well, it's fascinating on many levels. Number one, that you're able to combine these colors and produce other colors which create an object or an image or a motion or an ocean or its nature or its people. And it's fascinating that, number one, you can see that, but then more importantly, number two, that you can actually convey that on the canvas.
Yes, yeah. That's the non-local stuff, I think.
Really?
Yeah.
How much of your environment impacts your work? Where you are in Holland and what you do?
I think the environment does have influence, nature especially, when I walk with a nugget through a wood, through the woods or greenery. It's very special to me, hearing water as well. And that helps. That helps to get more visualizations. Yeah.
Would you be the painter that you are today if your vision didn't decrease?
No, absolutely not.
Does that boggle your mind?
Find that fascinating? I think it's fascinating.
Sure.
And I think it's very nice when I enjoy myself when people say, whoa, I can see this and I can see that, because then my imagination starts to run again.
Well, and please go ahead.
Yes. So that's really, and people enjoy looking at my paintings and become happy. And I like that.
Well, for a good reason, because they're all encompassing. They really draw, and this is coming from a visually impaired person as well. It's visually stimulating and just really kind of pulls you in. And we're going to look at a few different paintings so you can describe them to our listeners. Okay. If you're not on Facebook Live, you can go on the Progressive Radio Network page on Facebook Live. You can actually see these photos. And hopefully you were, because I was remiss in saying this before the airing of the video. But the first picture of the painting we're going to look at is Botanical Surge. Botanical Surge. If you can bring that up, we'd appreciate that. So you can describe that, Laura.
That was, I remember, I was in a beautiful garden, and it was spring. And that evening I arrived home at 11 o'clock, and I started to paint it. So I can describe it, but everybody sees spring and sees flowers and things coming up in springtime.
It smells like spring when I look at it.
And that's what I created at, I think, 2 o'clock in the middle of the night. Yeah, or in the morning. Yeah.
Wow. Celebration is another very vastly intricate but vibrant painting, and that's on the screen now.
Yes. Celebration is a red with pink and black background. I sometimes, when I wake up in the morning, see certain figures. And that started out in L.A., Los Angeles. And these figures are always happy. So I started to put them on the canvas with a black background, because then it pops. And, yeah, their figures are being happy. Or in and that's dance too.
Absolutely. The emotion that I feel evoked is that I want to become part of that painting and be joyously dancing throughout it.
Nice.
Our next painting is Cross Currents.
That's a special one.
Gorgeous.
Yes.
Why is it special?
Well, because it's... it's actually called Wild Orgasms.
That's quite special.
Yes.
Everyone is.
That's why it's so special. Yeah.
Okay.
But it's called Cross Currents now because I have a very good friend who said, you can't do that in America. Well, but I'm from Amsterdam, so I can say anything.
Absolutely. And everything goes on the Progressive Radio Network.
Exactly. Absolutely.
And I can see why that, because... Cross Currents, number one, I think they're both apropos titles of the Cross Currents. From what I can see from 6 feet across the room, it seems very luminescent. I feel like I'm in the bottom of water looking up.
Okay.
Remember those days in Curacao?
Yes.
When you were diving?
Mm-hmm.
That image that would get washed and the flow and the current that would distort images?
Yes.
That's what I feel that that it evokes, that emotion.
Okay.
And then the orgasmic one, we'll just leave that to everyone's personal interpretation.
Exactly.
Do you see white? Okay, moving on. Dance is next.
Yes. Well, that's I made that the same day or the same night as the celebration one. Figures again. And probably people dancing. And yeah. It's white with a stripe of pink, because the figures that I actually sometimes just see are wearing white gowns with a pink trim and a nice black stripe at the bottom. But they're men and women and children that are always happy.
The intricacy is just amazing, Laura. You're quite good.
Do you set
to do anything in a particular order or just exactly how you see it?
Exactly how I see it, and I get steered by doing things that are that I feel. Yeah. So it's really from my soul. I don't say heart, I can say heart too. But it's actually, yes, it's from my heart, and I try to really follow that and put that onto canvas and let people think when they look at them, because they tend to see more things when they look at it more than once. Yes.
I think that's true of a lot of different things, because I think mood affects everything. Because when you're mad, you can't think clearly. You can't think with a good solution. You just see red. for some people. So I think you have to be in a right mood, number one, to go see art, to experience photography, to experience anything that's going to require introspection.
I think so, too. Mm. Yeah.
And on that note, the next painting is called, appropriately, Transcendence. Wow. That looks like a shot from Hubble.
Yes.
Wow, that's just immensely complex.
It is complex, and I felt that when I made it too. But I it came up in my mind very quickly, or yeah, mind or whatever, and I placed it on canvas and let it dry, and yeah, people can see a face in it. And most people can, actually. Yeah.
Interesting. I'm far away from it, so I can't see that. To me, from this point, it looks, Transcendence is a great name and title because it has an evolution.
Above.
Yeah,
that, yes.
Yeah, a height component to it, mm-hmm. but also, again, from me being visually impaired 5 feet away from it, it also has a sea component, a water. Endor, an aerial globe world earth component as well.
Very nice. Some people see butterfly in it too. Yeah.
Well, they're probably in Amsterdam and smoking the ganj, right?
No.
Everything's about pot today, huh? Everything goes back to pot.
Yes.
So what, speaking of Holland and,
yes.
and living in Holland as a person, as an artist with a disability, what is the availability for services, for financial services, for even transportation compared to the United States? Is it easily accessible or are things hard to acquire?
I'll tell you my story because there are a lot of people that get a lot of help. But my problem was that my parents traveled a lot throughout the world. And I traveled as well because it got it in my blood. So I left from the Netherlands and wanted to study in Curaçao to do my practical time there. And that's when I got visually impaired. So I didn't have the things that you usually get when you become blind.
You're part of the system.
I'm not. Yeah, I wasn't. I was part of the system, but they didn't accept it that I was in Curaçao at the time. So I didn't get anything in the Netherlands except for taxi. And they're helping a little more often now because I'm showing my paintings around.
Being very vocal about
yes,
what you can and cannot receive.
Exactly. And well, I haven't been vocal about it at all. I think I should do it myself, be independent, and not be...
Yes, a burden of society.
No, I don't want that. I want to work and see if people love my paintings, try to sell them, and then do it myself. And that's really very important to me, that I can live my own life as I would love to. But it's a burden in the Netherlands if you don't get anything. And I think in America, when you have when you're visually impaired, you do get a lot of help, which is fantastic because I see it at the Seeing Eye as well, where there's people who come in, who get help, and get if they want to finish a study, they can. It wasn't possible for me when I came back to the Netherlands. It wasn't possible. Although I've got a Dutch passport, it wasn't possible. And that might be the thing that's going on around the world, that people, when you come from abroad, get more things done when you, yeah, if you're a survivor of a war. And that's, you have to help these people, but it's a pity that people that come from the country itself don't get the help as well. Because that makes it very difficult.
Oh, very challenging. Well, luckily for you, you're very gifted, you're worldly, and you're educated, and you're a survivor.
Yes.
So
yes.
All those components, a lot of those, you know, people with disabilities are, you know, across the gamut in terms of socioeconomic, you name it. But you're fortunate enough to have a good, solid backbone.
I have to.
Yeah, you have to. And you want to be self-sufficient.
I want to be self-sufficient, but it is a hard way, and I think people don't realize that because I am always
looking. Well, being an artist number one is not an easy route.
No, it isn't.
To get people to appreciate, understand, and to be able to create something that's so important to you that helps you survive in this world, like money.
Money really should be irrelevant, shouldn't it?
Everybody should
be able to eat, to drink, and to just enjoy life without the fuss of money. That's what I believe. And just love. And I remember saying that the last time I had an interview with you, talking about love is the main thing. No wars, just love.
That should be the core.
I think so.
I think it's the core of you.
Yeah.
It's the core of those paintings, because those paintings are, even just the name of them, they're not negative. They're positive. They're very bright. They're colorful. And so that's not coming from your vision. That's coming from your heart.
It is. Absolutely. Yeah.
So that right there defines exactly who you are and your perspective on humanity in the way you wish it would be.
Yes. Everybody should really have that feeling of no fighting, no guns, no, you know, all that stuff. It's just terrible.
So you've had some great exhibits in Holland and LA, correct?
LA, Amsterdam, and Amsterdam, quite a few, yeah.
And when is your next exhibit set for?
I've got one in Haarlem at the moment, but I've got a very special one coming up in Amsterdam in the Zuiderkerk. And that's where Rembrandt made his Nachtwacht.
Wow.
Yes, that's what the Japanese and the Chinese say.
That's pretty impressive.
It is. You can look it up on Google and it's there. So that's funny.
How does that reverberate with you?
I think it's very nice that I was invited to go and show my work there. Yes, well, going to, yes.
So as an artist, sorry for my naive question, do most works get sold through people going to exhibits, or through media, through the circuits, through people talking in the industry, and they go to your website and they come visit you? Or everything?
I think usually people call me and ask if I want to show my work, yes. That's what's happened up till now. And people talk, and
do you have private paintings that you don't want to share? Because they're too personal?
No, I actually don't. People can see my paintings, but there are private paintings that are for me.
Hmm. Hmm. Do you remember painting, and it could have been in a totally different style and method, and maybe not even on a canvas, when you were younger, and what you felt compared to how you feel now when you paint?
Yes, I can. I can. When I used to paint, when I could see, it was very, you look at something and you try to copy it, and when it's not right, the little line, you correct it, and you keep correcting because it's never good enough. And with this, I can't really correct it. It's just the way it is.
That's the beauty of it.
That's the beauty of it, and it's that's it. And it's very much more intense to paint now because it's really through my heart and soul. Yeah.
Did it give you as much pleasure when you painted when you were younger?
In a different way.
Yeah, but sure. Yeah. Did you feel free when you were younger when you painted?
Yeah, sometimes. Yeah.
So there are many components to living with a visual impairment. And I imagine for me, being visually impaired as well, I think they come out in many different ways. I do carpentry. I don't sell carpentry. I make objects and tables. And
lovely.
Yeah, I love it. That's my painting. I love making decks and furniture and just the smell of wood. I went to
Beautiful.
A factory. I told this story a week or two ago in Kentucky recently on a business trip, and I went to a factory where they make the most popular baseball bat in America, called the Slugger, Louisville Slugger. And I walked in that factory and I was just the smell of the wood alone, this timber, this raw timber that they carve into such a beautiful piece that obviously is part of America's pastime, baseball. I'm not even a baseball fan, but I appreciate the sport and the symbolic nature of just a piece of wood being carved into something that
beautiful, yeah.
You know, can create so much happiness and energy in America's favorite pastime. So when I think of outlets and painting and whether you have a good day or a bad day, painting and your fingers as your brushes will always be there for you and serve, never let you down.
No.
Have you ever done a painting that you, since your visual impairment has been to this degree, where you felt that it was just subpar and you weren't happy with it and you discarded it?
Yes, I've had that. I've had it a couple of times, and I put the painting away and I let it rest. And then all of a sudden, I get through what I have to do with it. So I do it. And it becomes one of the best paintings. Yeah.
I say one of these three questions that I get all the time. One of them is, so are you blind? I get, so you don't know what I look like, which has nothing to do with me, right? When people say you don't know what I look like, usually women would say that to me when I was single. Or the third thing is, so what can you see? So the million-dollar question for you is, you're asked all those three questions and more. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to describe to anyone how one can see, because hearing is easier to describe. But sight is a little bit more difficult because it's so unique and so hard to define in a diminished way, unless it's extremely severe. But for you, it may be a bit easier to describe since you did experience good vision at a young age, and obviously it decreased and then it drastically decreased. So do you have a way to articulate what you can see now, knowing what you were able to see?
Yes, very much so. Not always, but it is usually easy to describe. Do you want me to tell you what I see now?
I would love it if you did.
Okay. I have a black background again, and to the right, so I have a line right from the top to the bottom, and divided in two halves, and the right part is green, which means to me love, and the left part is red, and one part is black, so it's red, a little bit of black, and the whole half part green. It might be a little difficult to understand, but if no. You have a matchbox, let me put it this way, because that's the way I'm visualizing it now. A matchbox, half of it is green, a little bit is black, and the other part is red.
Does that change whether you're indoors or outside on a sunny day?
No, it depends on who I have in front of me.
Ah,
and I see, and I see these little silvery dots going through it.
So I'm love. I represent love.
Half of it, yeah.
I'm only half. I'm only half of a lover. Who's the other half, Nugget? Oh, I love it. Well, that was a good description.
Yeah.
So yes, it does depend. I guess it's specific to the setting. But if we were outside, would those colors be lighter?
No, they stay the same.
They do.
It changes. The moment I look towards Jan, they change. And so I don't know if it's the... I believe it's just my message for me alone. I'm describing it now and I'm trying to put it on canvas when I can. But it's my way to see people and my way to see the world. And yeah. That's really it. And the nice thing about the paintings is that everybody sees their own story in it.
That's the beauty of art. Interpretation.
Interpretation, yeah.
Laura Meddens, where would you ultimately like to see your art, and how would you like to have it impact the world?
Well, there's a very nice museum, isn't there, in New York?
Never heard of it.
You've heard of it.
We actually had a curator on here years ago, actually about 2 years ago, and she was visually impaired.
Yes.
I'll have to tell you about her.
Yeah.
Her last name is, I think, Gisseau.
Hmm.
Are you familiar with her?
No.
I think Annie Gisseau. Anyway, I can tell you about that later.
Okay.
But yeah, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, that would
exactly.
be
exactly. Yeah. But I think it's beautiful.
Or
I mean,
MoMA?
I think it would be beautiful when people just enjoy my art and like to hang it above their couch.
Do you have your art on your walls at home?
Yes, everywhere.
Everywhere.
Everywhere. Yeah.
Do you feel that artwork?
Yes, I do.
I mean, not literally feel it, but I mean, do you feel the presence of it?
Yes, I do. Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
Do you change them around or do they stay in that same position as they're initially hung?
No, I change them around. But I have one that always stays in the same place, and that's Tango.
What is your next painting?
I have no idea.
No idea.
That's a funny thing.
That's great. Well, yeah. What a great canvas to you have right next at your disposal being in New York City, because the activity and electricity, it's so palpable. So being visually impaired in New York City can be daunting. And I imagine it also can be exhilarating as well, especially when you go to the most famous stadium in the world tonight and Sir Elton John hits the stage. You'll be able to hear that and experience it most likely better than anyone in that stadium tonight, because you're just focusing on the sound.
Yes, and I, you know what the nice thing is to tell you as well, that when I see a concert, I get beautiful visualizations. It's so nice. I heard,
because it's euphoric.
Yeah, and I heard a concert before with all people's voices, you know, just voices and a couple of instruments. But it was just so beautiful, and I could see white light with gold, and it was just beautiful. I remember that. It was, yeah.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
LauraMeddens.com. That's MEDDENS.com. Your artwork's on there. Contact information, where your art will be exhibited, shown, and your bios, stories about, and more videos as well. So please check out LauraMeddens, MEDDENS. .com. Laura, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for making this a proper in-studio interview. I know you didn't come here for me, but thank you for making time for me.
You're welcome.
And Nugget is an absolute gem. He's absolutely gorgeous, your guide dog, and well-behaved.
He's lovely.
And thank you to the Seeing Eye Dog in Morristown, New Jersey, because they have been around for decades and doing incredible work.
They have.
And thank you to someone special who didn't want to be thanked for aligning this interview. You will remain anonymous, but we appreciate it. Laura, all the best to you. My name is Mark Farrell. If you'd like me to speak at your school, college, or corporation, check out markfarrellmotivation.com on overcoming adversity, drugs and alcohol, mental health, and more. Gary Knowles next, the founder of this incredible network. Have a great day.